phrase learning loss is questionable because in order to lose something, you have to have gained something. At the end of the day, it's really not learning loss. It's the unfinished learning that needs to be done in person that we really need to tackle with intense and comprehensive interventions.
Governor Gavin Newsom speaking at an elementary school in Santa Rosa yesterday, addressing the learning loss students have experienced after more than a year of Zoom school. California's elementary and middle school students, English learners, and students from low-income backgrounds saw significant learning losses in math and English. And that's according to a recent study of several California school districts out of the think tank Policy Analysis for California Education. So, how to fix learning loss and how do you do it without stigmatizing some students? Here to talk about this is Marisa Crabtree. She teaches high school English at Lincoln High here in LA. Hi, Marisa.
Hi, everybody.
And Dana Goldstein joins us. She's a national correspondent for the New York Times who is reporting on learning loss. Hi, Dana.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, Marisa, let's begin with you. What have you seen personally with your students? Has it been difficult to keep them up to task with their learning this past year?
So I think just like with all things that are related to people, you have students who are at different places. You know, there's highly motivated students, and for them, you know, learning from home maybe hasn't changed things that much. You know, they're still highly motivated and are sticking with school and are, you know, very good at independent learning and all of that. And of course, I teach high school students, so it is much more based on independent learning for the most part. But I think that you also see like a middle group, and, you know, those students are struggling to kind of stick with virtual learning and stick more with independent learning. And then, of course, I think that you see like a group that kind of disappeared from school. I mean, I don't think that they're really engaging with Zoom or with virtual classes. They're struggling to maybe have spaces at home that they can really sit and focus and study and be successful at independent learning. And I mean, and there's a lot of factors that go into that. There is a majority of students, though, that I feel like not having the social and the like traditional kind of constraints of a school day and being in person in a classroom, I think has affected how motivated they are and the level of work that they are achieving.
Right. And so that's to be expected. And the study really measured, though, a more significant learning loss with younger students. And Dana, what have you seen with regards to kids in grade school and middle school?
Yeah, certainly all the research that is emerging does suggest that younger children have borne the brunt of the shift to remote learning. And that's not surprising. You know, as Maritza mentioned, her high school students are more able to learn independently. When a kindergartner or a first grader, second grader, third grader sits down to participate in school over Google Classroom or Zoom, they very often need extremely hands-on help from an adult. And adults are not always available at all moments of every day to help kids of that age. So we do see in reading, especially, and to some extent also in math, that those early elementary years seem to be the ones where there's going to be the most recovery work needed to kind of make sure that, you know, foundational concepts that are very important to building children's knowledge over time can be learned when kids do return to school.
What are the key grades for establishing those foundational concepts?
Well, I think often people talk about grades K through 3, especially for literacy. You know, that's a window when, you know, teaching phonics, for example, is very important. The connections between the sounds we hear every day when we're talking and what we see on the printed page. So, and that can be hard to teach to some degree over the internet or even on video. So that is extremely crucial. And, you know, I have people talk about some of those elementary school math concepts like fractions, parts of a whole, being just incredibly important to all future math learning. So even before we get to the social emotional impact of school closures and the socialization that maybe didn't happen for all children to the same degree this year, those are some of the academic concepts that will probably need to be really prioritized as students return in greater numbers to in-person school.
And Marisa, are you at all worried that some of the kids that Dana just mentioned you're going to get in several years from now who won't be ready for you because of this last year?
Yeah, I definitely think that there is going to be a ripple effect where because of basic concepts and foundational information and knowledge not being mastered, that's going to be compounded through years and years of school. And by the time they get to high school, yeah, I definitely think that that's going to be a challenge. And I think we need to put a plan into place that addresses this, like, as soon as possible, rather than it kind of stigmatizing or like labeling this as like a lost generation. So although I do think that we could expect that it will affect how well they can master or pass classes. I mean, in high school, it's all about credits. It's all about getting the credits to graduate and passing classes so that you have your requirements to graduate and go on to college and a career or a training program. So I think that, yeah, we're definitely going to see that effect kind of trickle up into high school, if you want to think of it that way.
Right. And now, do you have some students, you think, who are not going to get the credits, enough credits to graduate on time?
Yes, we've already struggled with having a higher rate of fails in high school classes that, you know, where it's like, you know, usually you might have like, let's say a 15-20% rate of failure. This last year at the first semester, the fall semester, we saw like a 40-60% rate in some classes. And this especially, I think, affects the more complex classes. So if you're talking about advanced math, advanced science, but also like advanced English classes, like advanced placement, I definitely think that the failure rate reflects the fact that many students, it's just been a lot harder for them to keep up and master advanced, complex, abstract concepts without being in in-person learning.
Let's talk about some possible solutions. LAUSD earlier this week proposed extending the school year by 2 weeks, starting the next school year earlier, 1 week earlier, and then having a shorter winter break. Is that going to be enough, Marisa?
Personally, I don't think that's going to be enough. I do think that that's a little bit of like, you know, fantasy land thinking because 2 weeks to count for a full year of being, you know, closed, of having closed campuses, I just don't think that that math adds up any way that you slice it. I think that students need more consistent support. I think that there needs to be more after-school tutoring programs offered for high school students. I think there needs to be credit recovery, like lots of options and choices that students can do to recover the credits that they've lost. I think it might be expanding summer school, encouraging more students to take advantage of summer school. But I also think that we need to balance it. You know, a lot of students, they are motivated by some of the fun things in high school, like the elective classes, you know, band, choir, sports, things like that that they do. And I think we also need to be careful that it does not become where we're penalizing students and we're not allowing them to pursue some of those things that they want to do.
Mm-hmm. Dana, there is some concern that this whole discussion of learning loss is going to stigmatize a whole generation of students. And you reported on that. What are people worried about?
Yeah, I think, you know, I wanted to write about this exact debate and sort of amplify that concern because this phrase learning lost has been so ubiquitous over the past year. And I myself, wrote my first article about learning loss close to a year ago. So the evidence has been gathering for quite some time and that evidence, you know, isn't great. Like we do know that students have missed out academically, but I think, you know, I want to highlight what Marisa said, which is that there are solutions. There is research pointing us to what helps kids in these types of situations, whether it's intensive one-on-one tutoring, but also a focus on play and all the fun parts of school and mental health services, which will help get kids in the frame of mind to learn, because if they're not sort of thriving in other ways, it becomes harder to make up those missed academic concepts and sort of get back to basics. So yes, some people are very excited to use standardized testing to continue to gather data on what the impact of the pandemic has been. And others think that's, you know, harmful to students and not necessary, that we know, of course, the pandemic has had a terrible impact on all Americans and on kids, that we don't need, you know, sort of fine-grained data to understand that. And for children who've been out of school for a year, having them come straight back and sit to take standardized tests is not worth it, and it's a bad idea. So these are some of the nitty-gritty debates that state policymakers are having, that the federal government is having, and that, you know, local teachers, principals are having as well.
Right. And how fast can students bounce back if they are given, let's say, one-on-one or at least intensive tutoring?
That's a good question. I think that the ripple effects of this crisis, this pandemic, will be something we'll be looking at for years. I mean, no expert I speak to thinks this is one summer program or one year of recovery. You know, I'm more often hearing the words of 3 to 5 years, that these investments that schools will be able to make with federal stimulus money in order to help kids recover from the pandemic are not short-term investments, but something to think of in terms of at least several years down the line.
And Marisa, you're returning to the classroom fairly soon, by the end of the month. How are you feeling about it?
I mean, honestly, I think that it is mixed feelings. I am super excited to see students, but I do think that because at this point it's happening so late in the school year, and I believe that, you know, especially at the high school level, so few students are choosing to come back. I think it's also going to be, you know, a little bit of mixed feelings because there are going to be lots of students who you're still seeing only on Zoom. So I think that it's a transition to a return to normal, but I definitely think it's going to feel a little odd and weird and different when we first get back. But I am looking forward to seeing the students and seeing my colleagues, definitely.
All right. I'm inching forward, if you will, to some kind of normal.
Yeah.
I want to thank you both so much for coming on the show today. Marisa Crabtree teaches English at Lincoln High here in L.A., and Dana Goldstein is a national correspondent for The New York Times who covers education. Thank you both so much.
Thanks.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, why Sweden didn't do what other countries did when it came to COVID lockdowns. Did it work? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Sweden and its approach to the pandemic has become kind of a Rorschach test of sorts for people's views on COVID restrictions. If you think lockdowns, travel bans, and mask mandates are the right approach, you probably see Sweden as a failure. Unlike most every other wealthy nation, it held off doing those things. And the result was a much higher death rate than its neighbors, Norway and Denmark. But Sweden's death rate is lower than other European countries that did mask up and lock down, like France, Italy, and Spain. So naturally, if you're not a fan of those policies, you probably see Sweden's light touch as a success story. But what do the Swedes themselves think? Journalist Mallory Pickett looked into that question for The New Yorker. Her story is called Sweden's Pandemic Experiment, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me.
Well, as Europe was locking down, Sweden did not. Bars, restaurants, museums, schools, they all stayed open. Why did Sweden choose to do this iconoclastic approach?
I think there were a few factors at work. One of the big differences was that the public health agency, led by this guy, Anders Tegnell, an epidemiologist, was really leading the response more than the government. And he and his colleagues really felt that from a public health perspective, that the lockdowns didn't make sense. You know, if they closed down the schools, then they would lose a huge amount of their healthcare workforce because they would be at home taking care of their kids. I think one of the other big differences was that they didn't really embrace the role of asymptomatic spread. So there was a lot of advice to like stay home if you're sick. Whereas, as we've learned throughout the pandemic, that's not really enough.
And they didn't embrace masks for that reason, right? They thought masks were unnecessary.
Yeah, and I think even the scientists who were more sympathetic to the Swedish strategy were very puzzled by the decision not to recommend masks as more evidence piled up that masks were effective.
Have they changed any of these attitudes as the pandemic has progressed?
Definitely. I mean, especially as, you know, they, I think during the summer, cases in Sweden really went down a lot. And it was a time when it looked like, well, maybe this strategy is working and it's going to be easy to keep things under control. And then over the winter and Christmas holidays and everything like that, it really did get very bad. And around that time, the strategies did change a little bit. There were some sort of regional lockdowns, and masks are now recommended, but in a very limited sense. It's on public transportation during rush hour, and it's only even for people of a certain age.
And what's the general attitude towards wearing masks and physical distancing and not mixing with large groups of people? What do Swedes think?
Well, you know, a big part of the Swedish strategy and Tegnell and his colleagues' recommendations was about physical distancing and limiting large gatherings. You know, very large gatherings were limited fairly early in the pandemic. So restaurants keep people far apart, but people are still going out to restaurants. So it's just kind of a different way to think about it. But I think the recommendations that have been put forth from the Swedish Public Health Agency, which are keep your distance, wash your hands, stay home if you're sick, and those have been sort of repeated over and over, people really do respect those. At least I would say as much as people here are good at respecting the rules.
So how does that account for the fact that Sweden, while we would expect its rates to be higher, are not as high as they are in places like Italy or France or Spain?
I mean, I think that's really interesting and sort of why I wanted to write about this and write this piece. I just wanted to inject a little bit of uncertainty and humility into how we think about the way that we as a global community have handled the pandemic. There are clearly things about the Swedish strategy that have failed, but there also, I think, is maybe a little bit of a signal that some aspects of it worked. So the scientists I talked to were, as a whole, pointing out that something that needs to be done is to sort of study how each country has handled this and the individual elements of it, because it could be that Sweden, just by limiting large gatherings and really consistently recommending distancing, was able to prevent, you know, a certain number of cases just as well as countries that recommended lockdowns. It's worth evaluating how each country responded to the pandemic and trying to understand why Sweden wasn't quite as bad as we maybe could have predicted, why California, for example, wasn't quite as good as we were hopeful for, you know, when we had these really strong restrictions in place. I think there's just so much that we don't know.
So you're based here in California. Your husband is Swedish and your father-in-law is in Sweden. He has a severe lung condition you write about in your piece. What does he make of our restrictions and how is he handling the Swedish approach?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, you know, it's been really hard for me and my husband. He is the most vulnerable person in our lives and obviously someone that we really care a lot about. And yet, compared to everyone we knew in the U.S., he and my mother-in-law were not wearing masks. They were still having their friends over for dinner parties and just really couldn't be convinced to wear masks and stop doing that. And up until very recently, I would say, when the health agency started recommending people to wear masks, masks were something that was sort of hard for us to even talk about because we would just get into the same debates about the evidence for and against masks over and over again. Friendly debates, but it was still like we were just clearly coming at it from completely different perspectives.
And did your father-in-law or mother-in-law, were they healthy? Did they get sick?
Oh, yes. They are healthy. I'm so glad. It's been stressful, you know, because there's been a lot of times when it's been very bad in Sweden and we've been worried about them. They're healthy. And actually, my father-in-law just got his first vaccine.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
How are they with the vaccine? How are they vaccinating people and are people taking it?
Yeah, like pretty much the rest of the European Union, the rollout has been very slow, which is, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, I'm already vaccinated. I'm in my 30s and completely healthy. My father-in-law is in his 70s, has a lung condition, and this was his first opportunity to get the vaccine. So they're months and months behind us. Most of the vaccines they have are AstraZeneca, which has had difficulties that have slowed it down. So I think that's another challenge to their pandemic management.
Right. So how is Tegnell viewed now? Is he viewed as we view Anthony Fauci here in the United States?
I mean, he definitely has been that figure throughout the pandemic. He's enjoyed a lot of trust. You know, even one of the women I wrote about whose father died during the pandemic, and she's very critical of the Swedish response. Even she really made a point of saying, you know, I respect Tegnell, I trust Tegnell, but she just wishes the government had handled it differently. But I spoke to a lot of public health and epidemiology people who overall respected him, thought that there was something we could learn from the sort of lighter touch policies that Sweden had, while they still might have specific issues with, okay, why not recommend masks? Clearly something went wrong in the management of elderly homes because there was really high fatalities among the elderly in Sweden.
Oh, in the nursing homes, yeah. So eventually, so far, around 13,000 Swedes died since the beginning of the pandemic,
yes.
Half of them in nursing homes. Compared to Norway, which has half the population of Sweden, but it has had only 700 deaths.
Right.
So relatively speaking, in Scandinavia, it's a high death rate.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think that's where it becomes really hard to evaluate and say, what do you think about how Sweden handled it? Because clearly, when compared to its neighbors, it's done terribly. You know, it's a disaster. But there might be somewhere in between where some of their policies, if they had been combined with better control of visits to elderly homes and maybe masking, maybe there was somewhere in the middle that would have had a better outcome.
Yeah. So Sweden's population is around the same as LA's, LA County's, around 10 million, right?
Right.
So 13,000 Swedes died in LA. 23,000.
Yeah, and we had very different policies.
And a very different demographic makeup and all sorts of other factors.
Right. I mean, the biggest, well, now I don't want to like speculate too much, but I mean, there's a huge difference between the LA population and the Sweden population, because the Swedish population is spread out through, Sweden is the size of California. It would be as if LA was, everyone in LA.
Right.
Was out throughout all of California.
But that really illustrates just how hard it is to employ a single policy for various different locations around the world and
yes.
to understand exactly what works and what can be exported worldwide. I mean, I think there is a universal understanding that masks work to reduce the spread.
Right. And I think that's why it's so useful that different countries, I mean, you know, it's maybe useful is the wrong word, but I think it's important to look at, okay, countries, states, cities have all taken different approaches. And the message I was really hearing from public health scientists was, you know, people are just putting in all of these policies in place. We're doing everything at once, right? You know, lockdowns, closing schools, because it's an emergency. But because of that, we don't really know exactly how effective or what was the most important thing that was done. And so studying the way different countries and places responded to the pandemic is going to be a useful way to understand, you know, how we can handle the next pandemic.
Mallory Pickett, you can read her story about Sweden's pandemic experiment in The New Yorker. Mallory, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Crime patterns have changed, and why Californians are buying more guns, including so-called ghost guns.
You can even order these online, and then they're like delivered to your home, and you just like assemble them in the house.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, this year kicked off with an alarming rise in shootings here in Los Angeles. A little more than 300 people have been shot so far this year. That's almost double compared to the same period last year. That's according to LAPD's public statistics. Homicides and car thefts are also up. Other kinds of violent crime, though, are down. Crimes like robberies and rapes. Other major cities have seen similar trends. There have been many theories as to why crime patterns have changed. Lockdowns related to the pandemic, the BLM uprising over the summer, the election, all potential contributors. Joining us to go over the numbers is Ethan Ward. He's a reporter for Crosstown LA. That's a nonprofit news outlet that collects crime data from LAPD, the LA Sheriff's Department, and surrounding cities that include Pasadena and Santa Monica for analysis of LA neighborhoods. Welcome to the program, Ethan.
Hey, how are you today?
Great, thank you. Well, before everyone just runs to their doors and locks their doors and doesn't come out again because they're so scared. Let's note that there is a drop in crime overall here in Los Angeles since the pandemic hit. The trend has continued. But what are you noticing? What stands out to you in terms of the crime patterns in the first part of this year?
Like you said, overall crime is down. Even throughout the first quarter of this year, it's down 9%. Compared with the same time last year. But a lot of things like car thefts and people stealing car parts, shootings and murders, they're all definitely up. A lot of it is, you know, due to the pandemic and people being home, and particularly car thefts. Last year, there were like roughly 21,000 cars that were stolen, which was a 35% jump from 2019. And even this year so far, they're up nearly 33% compared with the same time last year. You know, you're a car thief and you see a car has been sitting for like 2 weeks, you know, and it's collecting dust. You're like, oh, this is like, you know, easy pickings. I definitely think it had a lot to do with, you know, people working from home. You know, their cars are parked for longer periods of time. So.
And also car parts like catalytic converters, I've heard, are being taken.
Yeah, which is crazy because I wouldn't even have been able to tell you what a catalytic converter is. But yeah, apparently they are. I barely can change the tires. But these parts are obviously very expensive. Mm-hmm. I guess the metal and the materials that they're made of, they make them really attractive for people to steal. And January was actually the biggest number of car part thefts in over a decade.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then we have more violent crime, as you said, shootings and murders are up. What are the statistics there?
So if a shot was fired, that's up 51% compared with the same time last year. But a victim being shot, we have our numbers at 86% up during the first quarter of this year compared with last year. So there were 371 victims shot between January 1st and March 31st of this year. And that same time last year, there were only 199.
Any theories as to why?
The consensus seems to be that it's economic hardship due to the pandemic. The pandemic, people are home, people are restless. I spoke to a gang interventionist who said that, you know, a lot of it has to do with gang activity. And so they're trying to work on like community outreach and using more gang interventionists and stepping up patrols. But yeah, I think most of it is just people, economic anxiety. People are sitting at home. You know, people don't know how they're going to feed their families, pay their bills.
And yet robbery is down, right?
Yeah. Robberies are down, but I think they're down like 6.5% during the first quarter of this year. Even though robberies are typically down, robberies at businesses are up. And assistant LAPD assistant chief Beatrice Gerbler said that they were seeing a disturbing number of people being shot during robbery attempts. So,
So armed robberies are up.
Yeah.
I want to pivot now and talk specifically about guns, gun violence, and shootings. And late last year, researchers at UC Davis found that more than 100,000 Californians bought guns during the first few months of the pandemic. Most of them were previous gun owners, but more than 40% were first-time gun buyers. This is not just happening in California, and we're going to talk about this now with Nicole Kravitz-Wertz. She's a professor at the Violence Prevention Research Program at UC Davis. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. Well, you've been listening in on this conversation with Ethan, and what do you make of the fact that the use of guns, gun violence, murders, all of that is up so substantially here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, so I'll just underscore sort of what Ethan has been saying. There's really no question that there was a surge in the most serious forms of violence, including gun violence last year, which has continued into the early parts of this year. It was really clear early on that what we were seeing was a collision of COVID-19 and this country's long-standing gun violence problem, with data suggesting that 2020 had more incidents in which four or more people were killed or injured due to guns than any of the past several years. Unfortunately, Black and Brown communities in turn have shouldered a disproportionate share of the burden of not only COVID-19, but also these incidents of interpersonal firearm-related harm.
So certain neighborhoods in Los Angeles are seeing a big increase and others are not, is what you're saying?
Yeah. So when it comes to interpersonal community gun violence, it's always been true that violence is highly concentrated, and last year was no exception. And this really, we know, doesn't happen by accident. Instead, inequalities in interpersonal community gun violence experiences and exposure are tied to discriminatory past and current day policies and practices that really have segregated many Black and Brown communities from resources and other systems of support that are the foundation of safety and health.
Ethan, when it comes to armed robberies and gun violence in Los Angeles, do you notice a pattern in terms of where this is happening?
Yeah, just to underscore what Nicole was just talking about when she said that it disproportionately affects Black and Brown communities, I listened to a police commissioner meeting back in February, and Deputy Chief of the South Bureau, Regina Scott, she was even saying then that in South LA, they represent 65% of the city's shooting victims. I think one of the numbers specifically that she had mentioned was that they had recorded 165% increase in shots fired, and then a 358% spike in victims shot, you know, just by walking down the street or sitting in their cars or in their homes. That definitely is something that's affecting, you know, just certain communities. Most of these things are definitely happening in, you know, Black and Brown communities, which is really, really unfortunate.
Yeah. And Nicole, let's get to your study. 100,000 or more Californians bought guns in the first few months of the pandemic. Why?
Yeah, so when we ask respondents about their reasons for acquiring a new firearm or why they changed how they store them, so just to take a step back, we also found that more than 50,000 Californians said they had started storing at least one of their firearms in the least secure way, that is loaded and not locked up because of the pandemic. So when we asked folks about that, most of their answers seemed to have some basis in feelings of fear and anxiety related to pandemic-induced uncertainty about the future. So there was worry about lawlessness or the government going too far, and just an overall perceived need for self-protection.
And then I guess if you have it, you might use it. You know, as we've just heard from Ethan, all these shootings are up. There's so many more people getting shot this year. Is it because there are just more guns and more guns at the ready?
There's probably a number of mechanisms operating here all simultaneously. But in relation to gun ownership and unsafe storage in particular, the evidence is very consistent. Easy access to an unsecured firearm in the home is associated with an elevated risk for firearm injury and death for everyone living in the household, particularly when it comes to unintentional shootings and completed suicide. And unintentional shootings, of course, are of particular concern as children spend more time at home amid pandemic restrictions on in-person schooling, while pandemic-induced suffering and loss can exacerbate the risk of suicide for vulnerable residents in the home.
Well, President Biden made an announcement recently that his administration will be cracking down on so-called ghost guns. These are homemade guns assembled by the user. They lack a serial number. They're untraceable, and they don't require a background check. So he wants to change that part of it. What is your reaction to his announcement?
From the research standpoint of things, I think there's a lot of good, promising, evidence-based actions that have been proposed by the Biden-Harris administration. Ghost guns are just one of them. Some of the regulations on the stabilizing elements of handguns is another. And then one of the really particularly striking elements of the executive actions that were proposed is this focus on what sometimes are referred to as red flag laws. And these are laws that enable law enforcement or family or household members to petition a judge to temporarily recover firearms from people who have been deemed to be at risk of harm to themselves or others. And here in California, these laws are called gun violence restraining orders. We had an early case study come out showing that these laws have been used successfully to avert mass shootings. Research from other states with similar risk warrant type laws have shown that they are successful in preventing firearm suicide. For every one warrant issued, approximately 20 lives are saved from suicide.
Wow. Ethan, are ghost guns a big problem here in Los Angeles?
Yeah, they are. I've actually spoken to a couple of gang interventionists who, every time we talk about this issue, when I'm writing a story about this, they always say that the biggest thing is ghost guns. And I didn't even know what those were. And I was so shocked to learn that you can even order these online. And then they're like delivered to your home and you just like assemble them in the house. A lot of times they're like plastic, but they still, you know, are just as obviously dangerous as, you know, other guns. And again, that police commissioner meeting that I listened to, they actually showed pictures of the guns that they would collect off the street. And they mentioned then that a lot of those were ghost guns.
Mm. Ethan, what about the policing part of this? There have been calls to, quote unquote, defund the police or at least redirect some of the funding that goes to the LAPD when it comes to you know, responding to traffic stops and things like that. Has that had any impact on crime as we're seeing it now?
Well, I think the LAPD will say that they had to divert resources away from handling these kind of issues. I think they've claimed that, you know, the protests last summer was a big reason that they had to divert resources. But community members that I've spoken to, I spoke to a woman, her name is Marsha Mitchell. She is the communications director for Community Coalition. And she said that, you know, community interventionists possess, you know, this firsthand knowledge and lived experience that would be, you know, useful in curbing violence throughout LA. So I think a lot of people are hoping that there's more funding for community outreach programs, gang interventionists, like to keep investing in that.
Mm. The $5 billion in the jobs plan for community-based violence intervention and prevention is a really great step towards centering the frontline on the ground community-based workers. And we know because the old model of policing really relies on responding to violence with brute force. And this might have short-term effects on reducing violence, but it can also cause immense harm to communities, really addressing and reimagining the systems that create the conditions that contribute to violence by expanding the concept of public safety to include not only or not even primarily law enforcement, but also things like housing security, thriving wage jobs, youth empowerment programs, and the like is definitely key.
Well, I want to thank you both so much for an important conversation. Thank you for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Nicole Kravitz-Wirtz. She's a professor at the UC Davis Violence Prevention Research Program. And Ethan Ward is a reporter for Crosstown LA. That's a nonprofit news outlet that provides data analysis of neighborhoods here in Los Angeles. Coming up, well, it is time to eat. Evan Kleinman went far and wide to discover the best fried chicken places in the LA area. We're going to tell you what they are next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes bake off, queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom, flames.
Bam, that's a little bam like that.
Pie.
Well, if you have been seeking culinary comfort in this past year, you are certainly not alone. A recent survey found that 2/3 of Americans say they have been eating more comfort food during the pandemic. Evan Kleinman is here to talk about one comfort food that Southern California has on lock. From Nashville hot to Korean to classic, there are so many great fried chicken spots here. Evan is, of course, host of KCRLB's Good Food. Hello.
Hello.
Well, I'm very excited that later on in our conversation, you're going to share a recipe from Jonathan Gold. So that'll be something to look forward to. Not that this entire conversation is not something to look forward to. But anyway, I can't wait to get that recipe. Let's talk about why we're so obsessed with fried chicken in LA. Why?
Why not? I have to tell you that doing the research for this segment was just a nightmare. I mean,
really? Good nightmare, though, right?
Well, I had to go out and eat a lot of fried chicken. But the only problem with ordering fried chicken in Los Angeles is who do you pick? And I'm going to talk about a few places, and it's not going to be the places that other people love. But that's just the nature of the expansiveness of our choices.
Well, good. I'm glad we're going to get some off the beaten path. And you have organized this, I understand, into four categories. What are they?
So the four categories are classic fried chicken. Then, of course, there's hot chicken. Then there's Japanese fried chicken, Korean fried chicken. I have a few fried chicken sandwiches, of course, on the menu. And then a couple of outliers that didn't fit into any category, but I want you to eat.
So that's five categories.
Yes.
Or six. That's six categories. You could not limit yourself to four.
No, it's okay. Impossible to limit. This is a subject that really precludes limitation.
Yes, I understand. Okay, let's begin with classic. What is classic fried chicken to you?
Classic fried chicken to me is crunchy on the outside, tender and juicy on the inside, all around comfort.
That just sounds like fried chicken to me. How is it different in other categories?
Well, the other categories involved condiments in some intense way. So, of course, hot chicken has all of the characteristics of the classic genre, plus endorphin-inducing heat at really scary levels if you choose to go that way.
And Japanese?
Japanese fried chicken is often boneless, often dark meat, often using rice flour instead of wheat flour or a combination. And the rice flour lends, rather than a crunch, a crispness, a kind of light, crisp texture.
And Korean?
Korean fried chicken is characterized, again, by some of the same attributes of Japanese fried chicken, but then there are the marinades that the chicken is tossed into. Some places you can get the marinades on the side as a dip, but real classic Korean fried chicken tends to be crunchy, but then also has this wet of a marinade.
Okay, I'm so hungry now. Thank you very much.
I'm
As
sorry.
Usual, let's get a few of the great spots that you recommend, and we'll begin with the classic.
I would say that for all around reliability, classic version in Culver City, a central place is Honey's Kettle. I just love their chicken, and I love him. Vincent Williams. I interviewed him and I have a link to that interview. But there's tons more on the list. Tons more.
Okay, so that list will be up at kcrlb.com.
Yep.
The entire list.
Yep.
Let's move on to hot.
Okay, so of course, Howlin' Rays. The first, the line.
Yes.
But I have to say the mild is really good. So the mild counts as classic. So people go there for the hot, but when I go there, I get the mild. What can I tell you?
Okay.
They also have a great sandwich. The other hot chicken in town is Hotfield Chicken down in Crenshaw. and Kim Prince of the famed original Nashville Fried Chicken family. That's where she placed her foot to start her own empire here in LA. I love it. It's great.
Hotville Chicken.
Yep.
Those sound good. Two hotties. And we have more on your list, again, at kcrw.com. Japanese
fried chicken. For me, I have to tell you that I tend to also have a prejudice of places that have more than chicken for you to order. So I like a copious assortment of sides. So Tokyo Fried Chicken in Monterey Park is really amazing. It's super crisp with fragile skin. And I think it has the best all-around spread of classic sides with a Japanese inflection imaginable. And next, Pico Nico. So Pico Nico is the brainchild of Chef Kuniko Yagi. And she's down in the Row, DTLA The Row. And she does a beautiful, super crisp, boneless chicken with also wonderful sides to choose from. But this weekend, she's doing a special collaboration with the genius banchan maker, Chef G.E. Kim of Perilla, L.A. And that is something definitely to jump on.
Mm. So that's like a Japanese-Korean mashup. You're going to get banchan and the Japanese chicken.
Yep.
And where do you get that deliciousness?
You call Pico Nico, and I'll have the phone number there on the website.
Great. And finally, Korean.
Okay, so my first pick for Korean actually isn't tossed with the marinades. It's like the OG version, and I love it, the one at the Prince. They do an unbattered whole chicken parts that are deep fried until the skin is just shatteringly crisp and the meat is tender. It's served bosom style with rice sheets and pickled daikon for your folding pleasure.
All right, let's get to the recipe, the Jonathan Gold recipe you wanted to share.
Okay, so Jonathan, every time he entertained at home, nearly every time, he would make fried chicken. And you would go to his house, everybody would be socializing, but there Jonathan would be in the kitchen with his suspender held up pants, barefoot, frying chicken in two different pans, one in olive oil and one in lard. And this recipe, I'm going to have a link to it. It's at the LA Times, of course. And what I love about this recipe and making your own fried chicken at home is skillet fried chicken. I know that it's impossible to do in a restaurant, but I still hold out hope that someone will take on the challenge, because I think skillet fried chicken is really the apotheosis of the genre. I like it so much better than deep fried
chicken.
I think because you're just standing over it the whole time and you're constantly turning it, and there's something about the way that the skin hits the bottom of the pan, so it's not floating. It gets a different kind of contact with the heat, and it's just so delicious and really good eaten at room temperature or even cold.
And which of his two chickens did you prefer?
Lard. But what Jonathan does for his chicken is he brines it in buttermilk with a little bit of hot sauce, and he uses this this salt blend that he always used to bring back from Tuscany, made by celebrity butcher Dario Cecchini. I love that. In the recipe, it says, if you happen to have it lying around. but the key ingredient in that salt blend is fennel pollen. So you can always just take fennel seeds and grind them up if you have to, if you can't find fennel pollen. But it's a wonderful recipe, and, you know, it's a nice way to honor my friend.
Yeah, it's a nice way to remember him.
Yep.
Again, a comprehensive list of the fried chicken spots plus Jonathan's recipe. They're up at kcrw.com. Evan Kleiman is host of KCRW's Good Food, which you can hear Saturday mornings at 11 right here on KCRW. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you.
Oh, I am hungry. Go check out that list at KCRW.com. Also, don't forget you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen whenever and wherever you want. It's at KCRW.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. I will be taking a couple of days off, and sitting in the seat tomorrow is the ever capable and lovely Michelle Aloy. So stay tuned to hear Michelle host the show tomorrow. I'm Madeline Brandt.